Hello again and welcome to the All Rachel edition of the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy. On the programme this time is Rachel Grimes, formerly and apparently entirely coincidentally, more of which later, of the band Rachels, with an apostrophe. But before we meet Rachel Grimes, we're going to take a dip with another Rachel, who's a keen follower of the Wim the Iceman Hoff method of musical composition. In recent times, the music of Dubliner Rachel Lavelle has felt the influence of icy seawater, both its effects on the body and its rhythms. A key part of Lavelle's practice involves collecting sounds to add unique textures to her music, everything from the sonic environment of a painter's studio in Lisbon to a chorus of crickets can find its way into her rich, expansive sound. The composer's time in Connemara fueled her interest in cold water immersion, but she also practices at home and in that very large and very cold pool off the Dublin coast, the Irish Sea. Culturefile's Áine Gallagher met Rachel Lavelle one final summer afternoon to practice some cold water immersion.
What do you reckon it's going to be cold?
I think it's
not going to be that cold.
Yeah, isn't it when it's cold? It's not actually that cold.
It's also September. It's the warmest month for the sea.
Is it?
Yeah.
Really?
It does look pretty grey though.
Yeah, there's something about the sea.
So are you creating music to the rhythm of the sea?
Sometimes. Sometimes I am creating music to the rhythm of the sea.
My name is Rachel Lavelle. I am a singer and composer from Dublin.
Should we get in?
Yeah, we should.
It's so cold.
Oh, lovely. Oh, no, it's actually lovely. Deep breaths.
I'm quite interested in, like, breathing and cold, like, immersing yourself in cold water to give you energy, and it's good for your circulation. And breathing and singing, they're all connected as well. Breathing, singing and swimming are all connected.
What is so interesting to you about cold water immersion? I mean, it's so painful to a lot of people.
I guess it's just like a good way to wake up, really. I did this course, the Wim Hof, the Iceman one. I did it for a few weeks. It's meant to be good for your circulation and your energy and focus. And yeah, you do breathing exercises and you do yoga. And you're meant to do cold immersion, so you maybe like at the end of your shower, you'd crank up the cold for the last 30 seconds, and then you build up your stamina with cold water.
Yeah, it's very cold. Come on, just get in.
Laurie Anderson said, when you're writing a piece, to check the rhythm, watch the sea and see if it fits to the rhythm of the sea.
In Connemara, I took recordings of, just on my phone, of like cricket sounds, and I played that at the beginning, but then I would have filtered it out so you'd only get like the high frequencies of the crickets, and I made them into like the equivalent of a hi-hat in a drum pattern. The standard hi-hat. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a cymbal, and the cricket sounds longer and more buzzy.
On a plane, on a train, some kind of neat me.
A lot of it is cute, quite vocal orientated, so I've been using my voice a lot more in different ways and expanding my register. In school I was a soprano and I would always sing very like high and very pure. And I guess like being more free in songwriting, I explored different registers in my voice because I have a very low speaking voice, so I was very confused.
Make love to me.
By how I spoke so low but then sang so high. So I wanted to bridge the gap. So I would use different pedals or samplers and spend a lot of time working on how you can change the voice.
Let me take the learning.
had an artist residency in Lisbon 2 years ago, and I since then have been recording different samples. I was in a painter's studio and I recorded like a lot of his materials, and I've been building up a sample library to make drum patterns and things. So that's like a nice way of bringing your setting into your music. It comes in strange ways as well. Like things that you wouldn't necessarily think would fit, can fit.
Kind of neat, meat, cute. I saw it better from the sea where I began to feel.
I think the sea kind of like gets its way into a lot of my music. I spend a lot of time in Connemara writing songs there beside the sea. It makes sense that it would feel like quite tidal. The Holdfast lyric is like about, Holdfast is sailors used to say that when the tides were rough. I guess that's like anything in like a relationship or like in some kind of difficult time. Just try and go with the flow, the flow of the sea.
Rachel Lavelle there talking to Áine Gallagher, and Rachel is on tour with Saint Sister at the moment, playing tonight and tomorrow night in the Pepper Canister Church in Dublin and in London on October 2nd. Now to Rachel of Rachel's. Rachel's was an ensemble that did much to create the genre contemporary classical in the 1990s, releasing and more recently re-releasing a series of hugely influential albums that married pianos, samples, electronics and even drums in music too vast and ambitious to be captured by the word rock. And where Rachel's went, Max Richter, Johan Johansson and others followed. At the heart of that group was Kentucky pianist Rachel Grimes, who was in Ireland this week to perform a live film soundtrack she created with guitarist Matthew Nolan to a Weimar-era German film, People on Sunday. But she's also about to release an album version of her first long-gestating opera, The Way Forth. Before we get to that, however, there is the business of some misunderstanding concerning the relationship of Rachel's co-founder, the now departed Jason Noble, Rachel Grimes, and the band called Rachel's. People often think that Rachel's was called Rachel's because there you were, the eminence behind it all. But the story is that that's not actually true.
No, we didn't see how calamitous that decision was to stick with the name. But Jason used to have a sort of solo project that was like, kind of influenced by Dead Can Dance and other sort of, I don't like to label it. Exactly, dark, gothy, introverted music. And he had sketched out these pieces for keyboard and voice and strings. He put the recordings on a cassette called Rachel's Halo, and that was with the apostrophe S, Halo. But that was his solo project, and when it got to the point that he and I had been making songs together and we decided to use a couple of those string pieces from the Rachel's Halo release and, put some of our songs together, it was like, well, what are we calling this? I remember that we really didn't love keeping the halo, and we thought, well, what's wrong with just calling it Rachel's? It kind of makes it more mysterious, like Rachel's what? It's like Rachel's imagination, Rachel's world. We liked that, and we stuck with that because that's what made sense. But it's actually not, the origin of the name is from Jason's obsession with the replicant Rachel in Blade Runner. So she's actually the origin of the name Rachel, not me. It's just that we thought it was kind of funny and coincidental that my name was Rachel and we stuck with it, but wow, yeah, I wish we had maybe not done that. But it's fine, it's what it is. Like I said, he was kind of into her, right, the character. So he also named his little Corolla wagon Rachel, and actually had it painted across the back of the back door.
There's basically an infinite recess of Rachel's in this project.
Yeah. And, you know, that was really, I had barely met him when he was driving that car around. So it's sort of like, you know, yeah, I think all things Rachel were sort of coming in his direction. And, yeah, it's just a coincidence. But there's a Rachel's yogurt here in Ireland. And then there's a crisps brand in the UK called Rachel's, which, you know, used to really crack us up. We'd go in and get bags of that on tour. It's a foolish endeavor to go to music school and get a degree in composition to begin with, which is what I did. It's not a career path. My hope was to just begin to get enough skills to know how to get the ideas out of my head and onto the paper, which, you know, at the time was actual paper with a pencil. It's a slow, slow process. Naturally, in music school, you meet all kinds of people. Some people were... you know, really, they were also like I was in rock bands or in different kinds of projects on the side. And I had a couple of friends who were making small pieces of theater and they wanted sound design. So I started, you know, just I didn't have much skill in that way, but I was like, well, I'll see what I can do. You know, I think you make the work that you want to make because it's in your world. You know, you have friends that are artists or they're making a different kind of music and you want to be a part of that. You just do it. I never expected to actually have the chance to write orchestra music or even really big chamber works. It was an incredibly difficult and slow process just to get a string trio piece written out and rehearsed and performed. I can't believe, you know, at this point, I actually have written for orchestra multiple times now. And, you know, I've written this giant folk opera, which is still not practical in any sense. You know, Rachel's was really just a few friends who wanted to make music that was not a rock band. But we knew that we wanted to make pieces that had more of this kind of string and sort of even film noir element to it, you know, than, you know, 3-minute rock pieces. That's all there was to it. There wasn't much of an agenda other than to just get to make the music we heard in our heads.
I was born March 4th, 1903, near Union City, Kentucky, in Madison County.
So the Way Forth, your first opera, is inspired by some sifting you were doing in the family archive.
I was dealing with a whole lot of stuff, as a lot of us can relate. Both of my parents were in declining health and needed help moving from where they were to, you know, more nursing care. My brother and I were just helping each of them independently to kind of transition. So that meant that within a couple of years' time, we were dealing with a lot of their stuff.
Most of the time, the teacher made the fires, swept the floors, and straightened up the room before any of the children arrived. Some of the girls and boys in the upper grades...
My mom was pretty well organized, so she had everything kind of in gear. But even still, you know, there's a couple of tubs of amazing photographs and letters and newspaper clippings and things that, you know, even if I had seen them, maybe I hadn't really seen him all in one sitting. And in the case of my dad's stuff, oh my gosh, he had stuff from his parents and their parents' parents and like 7 generations worth of documents, postcards, letters, really a real, you know, assortment of stuff. I mean, I think that some people might have just taken a lot of that and chucked it, but I'm not really like that. For me, it not only represented, you know, the people that I have come from, but there are just immediately these stories and these little hints into, you know, the way things used to be for people, how ways of life, little tiny glimpses into stories of another era. And so I was just enjoying that from a personal standpoint. It was also pretty painful, you know. I mean, trying to deal with all of this stuff and put it in any kind of order was challenging. The thing that really lit the fire for creating a piece was that I was trying to get kind of the best of my dad's family's photos together for a visit that some cousins were coming to visit. And I thought, well, it'd be great if we had just sort of the best album for them. And it seemed like in trying to put that album together, you know, in chronological order, it just seemed like something was taking place. There was something was unfolding. And it made me obsess more on getting to the bottom of who people were and what their stories were. I began working on the Way Forth in 2016, and it originally was for a small chamber group. And we were all going to sing all the parts in addition to playing all the instruments. And we were supposed to debut that at the Big Ears Festival in Knoxville, Tennessee, in March of 2017. And we had a dress rehearsal that finally went really well. It was very difficult. We hadn't had enough rehearsal, and we'd finally kind of gotten it right where it needed to be. And just a couple of hours later, I got a phone call that my brother had dropped dead of a heart attack in Louisville, Kentucky. And it devastated my world. And so we drove home, and we didn't perform the piece. All I could deal with at the time, you know, was this grief and losing my brother and everything that entails. And so the piece just, as far as I was concerned, disappeared. You know, I just didn't care, and I wasn't able to deal with it. And, you know, we never got to perform it. But my brother was a drummer and fabulous musician, and so central to my life. And kind of once I got on my feet a little bit, I thought, well, you know, I don't think he would be really happy with me just walking away from all that, especially because there's so much in this music and these stories that are about our family and our journey together. I wanted to figure out how I could find the strength to get back on the horse. And it took a while. It's Big Nickel Riding down Western Parkway. How can we have fun today? Let's go. A few years before this time, I'd say this was 15 or 20 years ago, I had put my hands in this basket, very old and crispy basket full of photographs and all this stuff, and I had pulled out an envelope full of these handwritten, you know, sepia-toned letters and documents. And one of the things that I opened was a bill of sale for a woman named Susan and her three children, purchased all at the same time by one of my ancestors. This was 1824, and it was something like $780. And this was a transactional occurrence that was going on all the time. Because a lot of my family has been in Kentucky for a long, long time, some of them were slave owners and some were not. You know, it really kind of depended on not only their economic status, but, you know, their choice in the matter. A lot of people in Kentucky were abolitionists. They didn't believe in slavery, but many did, of course. And I was just really taken with reading these words and thinking about who she must have been. And I have very few clues of what this woman's life was like, but I do have a song called Bill of Sale. It's an a cappella song. There's no words except the words "no more." Most of the singing is just ahs and oohs. And so it really symbolizes the community singing together and recalling that this is our past and wanting to commit to never being this way again. You know, this violent, oppressive past that is really the whole past of the United States and a lot of the world, really. The German film Menschen am Sonntag, which is People on Sunday, and it is a really beautiful experimental film made in 1930 shot with amateur actors. It's a really beautifully shot, interesting film of sort of everyday life, just a Sunday holiday out at the beach. I'm here to work with Matthew Nolan and Mary Barnicot on a live score. It has many, many layers to it, not only through the lens of these amateurs who actually show themselves quite clearly, but you see Berlin and you see what is the society like, what is this city life like. You get a lot of different flavors from seeing the daily life in Berlin at the time, including what you see are, you know, different military groups. You see sort of these imposing statues. You get this distinct feeling that this is a society that is militaristic, potentially growing more so without people maybe noticing. And, you know, when you think about the timeline, it is 1930. That hit us right away when we were creating this a few years ago in DC, and this was in 2016, mind you, was that the film wants to focus on sort of these everyday moments, these little dynamics between these men, young men and women, and what they're doing at the beach and their frivolity. But in the background, there's a bigger theme. You see what is life in Germany at this time. And, you know, this film was made by a team of filmmakers, some of whom actually had to leave the country within a few months or years of making this film because they were not safe to live there anymore. And, you know, I think the question on our minds was, you know, how much did these people perceive that their culture was under threat, really under siege? And, you know, it's a question that every day I ask myself as an American. I feel that we are under siege. I feel that we have had a coup in our government, which was in part led by a senator from Kentucky, Mitch McConnell. They have systematically taken over the judicial branch and the executive branch and are thumbing their nose at all kinds of rules that are supposed to be in place to help keep the three branches of government in balance. And it's a terrifying time because, you know, while some of the daily incidences with our occupant in chief, you know, are laughable and ridiculous and, you know, shameful, looked at through a bigger lens, you realize just how dangerous it all is. And I feel like we're seeing, you know, sort of ripple effect around the world, certainly in Britain, of this kind of flouting of power and rules. And rehearsing with the film last week at home, you know, it's like it's all there again, this feeling of like, how much did these people understand about what was happening in Germany's culture at that time? What we're doing with this film is really reacting to what we perceive that emotional environment to be in the scene between the characters, perhaps behind the scenes in terms of this like social setting, and kind of the underlying emotional terrain. You know, we just would improvise with it. We'd come up with a couple of little, you know, maybe he would come up with a handful of ideas for this scene, or I would come up with some for this scene, and then we would add on to each other's ideas. The guitar and the piano are very interwoven, so sometimes you're hearing them very much, you know, in a sort of gelled texture, and then sometimes, you know, one will come to the foreground for just a moment, and one will be playing more of a rhythmic role or a textural background. You know, one of the things we really, I think, we're working on was how to get the resonance of the piano and the reverby guitar to sort of resonate together and sound almost more like this single instrument. an instrument that you might play all at one time. You know, it's just got these different tonal qualities. So yeah, you know, we really wanted it to be a blended sound. There's a couple of scenes in the movie where you actually see people just walking through the park in formation. And you're like, how did that happen? You know, this was not a rehearsed scene. This is just shot. Like, what was going on that everyone's feeling this vibe to walk in formation? Is it because there was an increasing sense of military in daily life? I don't know. It's a disturbing feeling. And of course, we were working on this film before Donald Trump was elected. And, you know, the conversation at lunch most days was, well, it's not gonna happen, right? I mean, this is just an absurd, you know, distraction. And it still is, but it's much more dangerous now because it actually happened.
Rachel Grimes there, and the album version of her opera, The Way Forth, will be out in November. Before that, she'll be performing the live score to People on Sunday with Matthew Nolan at Triskell in Cork tomorrow, Saturday, 28th of September. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more nominative happenstance next Friday at 7 here on RTE Lyric FM. Till then, bye now.